I, of course, want to express my thanks to the conference organizers. And I express them not only on my behalf, but on the behalf of my co-author, Nick Constantino. Because we have 20 minutes, it was decided that I would give the paper, but this paper was truly written by the two of us. One should not take his contribution lightly. I'm going to first talk about the main ideas of the paper, because as is typical for conference, no one ever gets the papers read in time. Here are the main points of the paper. It was a lengthy paper, you can figure out whether it's worth consulting afterwards. Our strongest point, point number one, is that there is no ritual system in place in Zhang Di's reign. That's 300 years into the Han ruling house, and 55 years into Eastern Han. And were a system to be in place, we would expect it, as you will soon see, to be described as a fixed ritual, a ding li, or a bei, a completed ritual or set of rituals. And what we'll see from the slides is there is no such dinging, fixing, and completing. The second point I would emphasize is that the ongoing debates about ritual concern nearly every possible aspect of ritual. Who is actually being honored in the ceremony? Who performs the ritual? Who attends the ritual and why? Where are the rituals to be performed? And are the rituals to be conducted at regular or irregular intervals? Those are just the biggest questions that are being asked. My third point is that we often, and I completely put myself here, take a line from a treatise and go, okay, now we know what's going on. And the view from the top, either from the basic annals of the emperors or from the treatises on ritual in the Hanshu and the Hohanshu, that couldn't be more misleading in failing to discuss debates on ritual. The Hohanshu, quite unlike the Hanshu, does concede that the rituals are piling up and they're more and more possible models and more innovations, and so gives you the sense that now something is actually going to have to be done. My fourth point is that to find the ritual debates, one must consult the individual biographies in the histories and the extensive controversial literature that exists from the period. And my fifth point is, the reason this talk and the paper in general focused on Zhang Di's reign is because we happen to have for that period an unusually great number of biographies of ritual masters, and also two major works of controversial literature, the Bohutong, the White Tiger Hall Conference, also Xu Shen's Wu Jing Yi Yi, which is available only in fragments, but hefty numbers of fragments. So we can gain from it a sense of these ritual debates. Okay, what I mean is we often look at the top. If we looked at Ming Di's reign in AD 59, we are told, these rituals were finally completed. Okay, so fine. We look at that and the language is bei, completed, it's unambiguous. The only problem is that if we go two emperors later, we have a ritual master saying, gee, I hope before I die that something gets fixed and actually completed. And really, one can multiply these examples over and over again. The main point is that in all of my readings from Zhangguo Qinhan, I have never seen a fixing of the ritual. And I think the answer is these are too important, and there are too many precedents to argue from. So not just the ritual texts. In fact, in the Han period, you're usually arguing about what rite should be done on the basis of the shangshu, the documents. So we have to see a much broader picture in order to know what we're actually looking at. So I want to turn to a ritual master who slightly predates the period. And that's because I want to speak about him. He is so important to the whole Han Dynasty legitimacy project that Ming Di virtually invented. There's a precursor in the Wangmeng period, but Ming Di virtually invented the honoring aged ceremony in only to honor him. And what we have is Ming Di positioning him and asking other ritual masters to stump him, basically, to give him hard questions. And then whenever Huan Rong answers, Ming Di says, that is the correct answer. And this is part of the positioning of Ming Di as a legitimate ruler. At one point, Ming Di, with another, some same family of Huan's, presents himself. He says, I am Confucius, and you are my disciple. And now this kind of teaching will go on. Okay, so what I wanted to say is, here's a typical, if you look at the biography, here's a typical biography of a ritual master, except the odd thing about this biography is of all the ritual masters that I have examined, this is the only person who does not hold a high military position at the same time. And I think it's because he came to court at the age of 60. He's probably already past his military years. But I think we frequently contrast ritual and law or ritual ways of doing things plus military. And if you know the classics, I think that's an anachronistic division. So I wanted to bring him up simply as really an exception, but a powerful exception. Here are some of the other people we examined. We could have added more than this. And you see that they served in quite high positions in the military, as well as being master of ceremonies at the imperial rituals. So I wanted to turn now to the most important ritual master during the time of Zhang Di, and this is Cao Bao. Zhang Di, and he's a much debated figure all the way through the Ming Qing period, because the question was he filial or not, because he didn't bury his father according to the previous rituals. Zhang Di occupies, he's undoubtedly the most powerful Eastern Han emperor, and he really wants to revise rituals and music for himself and for the strength of the dynasty. So he goes to Cao Bao and says, I want you to redo it. We had Shu Sun Tong in the Western Han, I want you to do it for the Eastern Han. And he creates an enormous work that is in 150 chapters. Okay, for those of you who know Chinese, you know what that means. Many, many times the normal length of the rite's text. But I would draw your attention to the bottom under career highlights. First of all, he's credited with all kinds of achievements in his own lifetime. But as soon as Zhang Di dies, the accession and capping ceremony for the successor follow Cao Bao. And then officials say he should be executed. And so this brings up the tension always about when do you revise, when do you not revise. And in many of these discussions, the theme is this, that the only precedent is you must keep revising. Every ruler adds to this corpus and innovates and changes. We now have a selection from the paper. What Cao Bao tells Zhang Di, he knows Zhang Di wants to revise, and what he tells him, but he's not alone in making the same argument, is that to be a real emperor, you must revise the rituals and the music, and you have the legitimacy to do it. After which, he's commissioned by Zhang Di to do this, and then Zhang Di consults Ban Gu, who's familiar to us for other reasons as the author of the Hanzhu. And Ban Gu says, no, you don't leave it to one man to do it. You convene another court conference, just like the Bohutong in 79. And we will solve all these issues. And Zhang Di says, no way, I've had it with court conferences. I need one person, just as Shun needed one music master, Kui. One is enough, okay? But what's interesting is Zhang Di, in his own lifetime, never forces these new ritual on his own court, which tells you something about the most powerful emperor is fearing the reaction of his own court. I'd like to turn to some of the ritual controversies just to give you a sense of how profound they are. We begin with the Ming Tang, and I think immediately of Michel Pirazzoli, who said that the Ming Tang is a pâté de choux. And I said, what do you mean, a cream puff? She said, a lot of hot air. Okay, so actually, I think it's a little bit less air than some later accounts have made it. The first thing that's really surprising is, according to Cheng Dacheng, who knew more about Chang'an and Western Han than any scholar I can think of, there was no Taishya in Western Han at all. And it's very interesting that so far I don't believe any archaeologists have found anything to be identified as such. The second thing is equally interesting. Ming Di, this powerful emperor, nearly dismantles the Taishya. By the way, we translate the Taishya erroneously as a university, correctly as ritual center, or maybe academy, imperial academy. As long as we think of the Greek model of academy, that many things are taking place there. He nearly dismantles this on the grounds that it's superfluous. He has a biyong. Why does he need a taishya? The taishya is very small in Eastern Han. It could not possibly hold the numbers of students that are reported of it in the Hohanshu by a long shot. And I'm not the first person to know this, Lu Semien, but as you'll see from the next slide, it's totally impossible. If they have correctly identified the taishya, it's tiny. And it could not hold tens of thousands of students. I want to say that the role of the Ming Tang is very unclear, as multiple texts, including Cai Yong's essay on that subject, the Ming Tang Lun, equate the Ming Tang with the Taimiao, the imperial ancestral temple. And they simply say, when we're doing focusing on certain kinds of ceremonies, we call it one thing. When we're focusing on something else, we call it something else. So I immediately went to go back and look at Hans Bielenstein, and where did he locate Luoyang in later Han times and imperial ancestral temple? He shoved it up in the north, but there is no text attached to it. There is not a single record of where it should be. So it's a very peculiar thing. I mean, he clearly wanted to put it on a map, but he never discusses it, and Hohanshu doesn't discuss it either. The plan of the Ming Tang is not at all the same in Western and Eastern Han, confirming that there were debates about what it should look like, how many rooms, what its function was, all of that. And the Biyong and the Lingtai functions are very clearly specified, and they're ritual centers each for certain ceremonies. Okay, so they're not problematic. So I just let you look briefly at the Western and Eastern Han Ming Tang. The furthest away from me is the Eastern Han. This is the Western Han. We have what has been identified as a Ming Tang in the Western Han, and it's a peculiar complex that doesn't actually match any ritual text or any text from the Han period. Okay, so we simply kind of look at it and wonder what we're doing. Turning to the Eastern Han Ming Tang, if you look at the big red arrow, that is the entire site of the Taishui as identified by archaeologists. If they have identified it correctly, it occupies 6 acres. The central campus of Berkeley is 123 acres, the full for the same number of students for the Taishui. And the whole campus, which is to take that entire number, is 1,232 acres. Okay. When you read Han Dynasty accounts of what's going on, and Lu Simien knew this in 1920 and 1930, what you're talking about is clients who may at some point attend a ceremony, and they get honor from having attended that ceremony. So clearly there were some Boshir and they did have disciples, but clearly at some point in the Eastern Han, disciples and clients fail to be distinguished and the numbers just start being inflated beyond belief. So whereas many people, I emphasize this, whereas many people take the sign that there were 30 to 40,000 students at the Taishui, and then they say Imperial Academy as a sign of growing literacy in the period, it's crazy to do this. Okay, I turn to another ritual controversy. And it's the identity of the 6 origins. Gu Jiegang has identified 21 different theories of what the Liuzhong are, but I give 7 that are extremely important in the Han period and the subject of ongoing debates. Now, if you think about it, this is the most solemn sacrifice that the emperor makes to whom? He doesn't apparently know whom he's even offering his ritual to, nor does his court. So again, we can think of orthopraxy. He knows that he must offer this sacrifice, but the theological questions which often plague us, what does he think he's doing, I think are completely irrelevant to this issue. He knows he's being reverent to the powers. That's enough, okay? And that's enough to demonstrate his superiority. If we look at the 5 sacrifices, it's exactly the same thing. Here are the main questions that are asked, and if you look at it carefully, it's every single question that could be asked. Who are the 5 sacrifices? That's never settled. Who are the objects of the cult? Who's allowed to offer cult? At what level? Different people think from the emperor on down to the common people. Some people think only the emperor. Some people think only the commoners. You begin to go, really, I just don't know what's going on. And I'll simply mention the 3rd. At the 5th 5 sacrifices, some people say at each of the 4 seasons you do this, and then at the midsummer section you worship the 5th. That makes great sense in cosmological terms, except no one can agree on that. Okay, and so they do not agree whether it's regular or irregular, and some people would say you make these sacrifices on the point of death. Oh no, you make these sacrifices when there's been an earthquake or a flood. Oh no, you know, so there we go on. We produced an appendix which has a number of items in it, but really, every single issue here is up for debate. Accumulating precedence doesn't resolve anything. What it does is complicate the decision-making process and make it, I think, impossible to resolve. So I end my talk there and bring us back to the original point that Nick and I wanted to emphasize. If you read, and it's not just Chinese, but they're always talking about the ritual system as stretching back into hoary antiquity. The key point is, as horrified as I am by a wedding couple inscribing the Chinese constitution on their wedding night, there's never been a ritual system, and it's only been in some people's minds that there ought to be a ritual system, and that was a powerful notion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for this always quite challenging point of view, and in fact, reminding us of what was also said this in the first round with by Alain and Marianne, that this gap between the text or the let's say the liti as a symbol and the reality.
Yeah.
So for the morning rites, which are supposed to be the core of the liturgy and all the Confucian or literati tradition, even there it's doesn't work.
Even Zhu Xi can't figure out.
But speaking of Zhu Xi, this will be
yes.
But let's say at least for the Zhang, the ancient period up to the Han, you now show from the historian point of view that also you have that gap in the Han. There was also the same problem that. So, my question there maybe, and I open the floor also, would be: so, what are these texts for? Are they just creation of this classicist literati group of people, philosophers or whatever, who have this phantasm about having this perfect order, or is it something else coming from? We can go to also to what Mike Puet told us this morning, this kind of aggregation, I mean, bottom-up construction of those rituals. How do you see that?
I have two tentative answers. The first is from the top, and the first is from a slightly lower level, the people who are creating these texts like Bo Hutong and Wu Jing Yi. From the top, and this is a very crude analysis, but that's the only place I am at this point, at the level of crudity. From the top, it is extremely clear that the Eastern Han, even under Zhang Di, the most powerful emperor, does not have the power that the Western Han had, and they know it. And so instead of ruling as Bawang, as hegemons, they say, we as emperors will become ritual masters and patrons of classical learning. And of course, this began in Western Han, that this would be another source of legitimacy. That's the view from the top. From the view of these people who are doing it, I had a small section in the paper, and really it should be developed by both of us, and that is why do we keep seeing this mess? Why don't they leave it alone? We tend to forget, because we read this as disembodied people and ideas and things like this, that every ritual, the participants at the ritual gained prestige and authority themselves from participation in the ritual. It's so clear in some of the Eastern Han tombs and the murals that participation in these rituals put you in the power circle. And so I think the reasons why people can't get rid of these debates is, say, I'm the teacher for the Ouyang documents, and you're the teacher for the Qingshi Li, the rites. My authority depends on my winning out in these debates, and I will then be rated more highly My teacher is Nathan Sivan, and I honor him in all respects except one. He said the Chinese were irenic, peaceful. No, this is a competitive arena, and they are always jockeying to get closer to the emperor and closer to the Wai Chi and other sources of power. So it's a crude answer. I'm sure it's more complex than that, but this is my initial crude sociological answer.